This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Halloween. That means tonight ghosts, goblins, gremlins, and all manner of imaginary monsters may be knocking at your door. But while Halloween is all about make-believe, for some people the business of paranormal phenomena is serious. Sally Rhine-Feather is one of those people. She's Executive Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center in Durham. The center's been around in one form or another for 70 years, and in that time, it has investigated such unexplained experiences as telepathy, clairvoyance, and life after death. Sally's father, J.B., was a trailblazer in the field of parapsychology. He came to Duke in 1927. He was one of the first people to try to legitimize the investigation of the paranormal. Sally Rhine-Feather has continued in her with her father's legacy, and she joins us now in the studio to tell us more about it. Welcome, Sally. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
By the time you were born, your father was already well established in Durham. He was investigating the paranormal. What do you remember about his work as a child?
Well, my earliest memories were really of a lot of people around the house on the weekends, jumping up and down with new discoveries or things. These were students, graduate students, colleagues, young people. Very excited about something. I didn't know what it was, of course. I just knew that everybody seemed to be very happy. And it was like an extended family.
When did your father, or how maybe is the question, did he become interested in this himself?
Well, it went back to he and my mother both together, always a pair, being young students at working their way through the University of Chicago. And having been disappointed with they came to college, had lost the faith of their childhood belief in religious beliefs,
religious faith, yeah.
Because they couldn't square it with science. My father particularly was a very serious young man, so it had to, after he discovered science, that was like a religion to him. So he couldn't make sense of it all. But then in the graduate school, one day one of his professors told a story and that intrigued him a great deal. Shall I tell the story?
Okay,
he said, one night when I was a boy, I had been awakened by a neighbor who wanted to borrow a buggy. This was back in the early 1900s,
yeah,
or something like
that. Sure.
She'd had a dream in which her brother had shot himself in the hayloft. The next day, we learned that she had indeed arrived at her brother's house 7 miles away to find him in the hayloft with a bullet in his brain. This account, told by a professor in a serious class, I guess he got off topic a little from plant physiology, it intrigued my father. This was the kind of thing that, if it were true, would shake up conventional ideas and would have something to do with the extent of the power of the mind. Then they also heard another scientist came to town, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, originator, physician, scientist. He felt that he was in communication with his son who had been killed in World War I, and he was a spiritualist. Now, that didn't convince my father, but it added to his, here's a scientist who's taking this sort of thing seriously. Why can't science pursue this type of topic? And that festered for a while, in several years, and he and my mother finally gave up promising careers as plant physiologists, chucked it all, and redirected themselves. And ultimately, after some study at Harvard, ended up here at Durham, North Carolina, because of Duke University, because of a professor here at Duke who was open to the idea that these things could be, you could look at this topic in an academic setting.
Had any of this work been done, or what kind of work, had the Academy been taking it seriously at this time, around the turn of the 20th century?
A very little in this country, an experiment here or there. In England, yes, the Society for Psychical Research, which is still in existence, had been investigating stories like the one was just that intrigued my father. These claims from all cultures and all, you can sit beside somebody on a plane and before long you'll hear this story, a similar story. And I get them not every day, but several days in the week I get stories like this today. These stories have been around by seemingly sane, normal people, and yet science had not had no real answer after you rule out people don't remember just right, and so forth.
And it's an interesting period in history. You mentioned Conan Doyle. Again, here is the architect of the logical mind. I mean, this is Sherlock mm-hmm. Holmes. Everything is elementary and deducible, right? Mm-hmm. And he was a spiritualist. It seems mm-hmm. that people like your father, Conan Doyle, and others, you can go back to Swedenborg centuries earlier, find the limit, somehow press themselves mm-hmm. against the limit of what science can do as true believers,
yes.
and then say, you know what, all right, what about the stuff we can't answer?
Yeah, yeah. And can we just do we just sweep it under the rug because it doesn't make sense? You know, that would be politically the thing to do,
mm-hmm.
perhaps in most departments. But my dad and mom, at young students like that time with no affiliation at that point in time, were still open to the great belief that if you take the scientific method and apply it properly, that you'll get some answers. At least it's the finest tool of man's rational mind that we know.
Now, you said in Europe there were some others who were pursuing this. There was an open mind in Duke. But in general, how did the academy in the United States, was there open mm-hmm. resistance to this kind of
yes,
thing?
Yes, there absolutely was. In fact, it's remarkable that there was here, Duke University was a very new university. And those are the times when universities are most open to new ideas. There isn't a board of trustees that's watching out for things that are controversial or quite as hard as they might later. And so that was they were open to at least looking at it and seeing if we can study these things and look at them in an academic way and applying the tools that were quite typical at that time in psychology labs.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those. Your father set up a parapsychology laboratory. What did that mean, and what precedents did he – I mean, where did he come up with the idea and the actual tools and methods?
Right. He was a plant physiologist, so his idea of science was not – but he had gone to Harvard and studied for a year and to get the training a psychologist might get before he came down here. And with McDougall had just moved from Harvard together with McDougall, Professor William McDougall, a very broad-minded British psychologist who was actually at war with the behaviorists of the day because he believed there was such a thing as the mind. In those days, psychology sort of had lost that concept. Anyway, they figured out, well, we can't find an answer to is there an afterlife, as the story from Conan Doyle might have suggested, but we can at least see if normal human beings have some way of getting information without the use of the senses. If the claims for telepathy that the people, the popular public believed then and believes now, those could be subjected to scientific study. A few studies had been done elsewhere, but they had not been followed up on. So at beginning at Duke was really an effort to study something in a systematic way. And then if it worked, then continue that and become a little more scientific and improve methods and go on as all sciences begin from observation and move to control. That's what it was here.
And what do you know about those early experiments?
Yeah, those early experiments, because, see, I was born in 1930. So here we are. They're studying it already, but by 32, 33, 34. By the time I was in the third grade, for instance, I could bring my friends up to the Duke Laboratory, and they were glad to have little children who were excited about being subjects. And they were very simple methods that psychology was already using in studying things, adapted to studying something that they couldn't put their finger on. You know, you study a memory in a certain way. You give people a certain list of syllables to memorize. Well, in this case, you ask people to guess something that they couldn't see. In this case, they used some simple card designs by Professor Perception, Dr. Zener, had designed for them at the early days in the laboratory there. So we were guessing as a child. We were doing card guessing games, simple games. You could still do them today. It depended upon the statistics to tell if something really remarkable was happening. Then you couldn't explain by statistics, or you could get a figure. The chances of this happening are 1 in 100, so forth.
But that would suggest then that what you're looking for are extraordinary individuals. In other words, it's not that we can all do this, or then there'd be no baseline. There'd be nothing to compare it against. So was your father, essentially they were looking for extraordinary individuals, people who had highly refined powers.
That's what they did. Although you could do a group test and get results, but best things happened when they tested Duke students and found certain ones of them scored well. So then they started new experiments, controlled experiments from beginning to end. And among that group were some really high-scoring people. And on the basis of those experiments, by the time 1934 came around, they were able to publish 90,000 trials. That many attempts had been made. And so they had some really remarkable results in that first publication in 1934.
So they felt pretty confident they were onto something. What did the rest of the academic world think of their research at the time?
Well, after it got published, then there was criticism came, as it would, as appropriate in any new happening, any new science. one should be critical and careful. So, and first of all, the public was thrilled, and all these letters came in, you know, oh, this is wonderful, and let me tell you my story, and so forth. The critics and the scientific critics examined the data pretty carefully. A few places began to replicate and got similar results. That was the way it should be. Others said, no, this can't be, and here's why. And then they would improve the methodology. Some of the criticisms were helpful. And over the years, they gradually improved their methodology. In those early days, they didn't have computers. So my first job when I was 15 years old was to help recheck the data by hand. Everything had to be checked twice. And, of course, there was no computer to do it that way. But, yes, yeah, so the critics were there in force. My dad even spoke to the American Psychology Association, made a big presentation in 1937. He called it the heresy trial because it was like heresy to be studying something which you couldn't explain. But that went well at the time. Ultimately, the AAAS, the Society for Advancement of Science, accepted parapsychology into their fold, albeit reluctantly by some of the members. But
he was things making moved progress. Along. We will find out how they moved along and how your career moved along, Sally, as we continue our conversation. I'm talking with Sally Rhine-Feather, the Executive Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center in Durham. And you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Sally Rhine-Feather, Executive Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center in Durham. You talked about being a young girl growing up, hearing all of that stuff, the excitement of the grad students as the experiments were going on and the research. What was dinner conversation like? I mean, was Dad and Mom always talking about it?
Yes, they pretty much were. My mother was very much involved in this. She had four children, so, and in those days, women did not, you know, and they stayed at home until the youngest one was in high school. So, but when that happened, my mother took on the job of collecting the stories, the type that I mentioned. My father, it impressed him. Well, they were by that time they were coming in by the hundreds, and nobody was answering them. You know, so she just did, you know, being one of these people to be helpful. Well, okay, I'll answer them. And in the process, began to realize, you know, there's a lot of material here. These stories can help tell us something. At that point, by that point in time, 1948, when she began, they had established sort of the big four, evidence for telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, and even psychokinesis, which I can define later. But those phenomena had sort of been established fairly well in the laboratory by the data. So they thought they could spend a little more time, and let's look at those stories in those cases which led to this work to begin with. Let's look at them and see if we can learn something about the people who had the experiences.
What when she said, let's look at them, because your dad was already doing some of that, but it tended to be more like measurement, right? How many times can I guess right, essentially?
Exactly.
Right? You measure that. It sounds to me like she was looking at a different way of examining.
Right. She was looking at the stories and what are the similarities? What can we learn from them? Now, she didn't have email like I do today, so she couldn't write back and get another reply the next day. So she had to just sort of take them on face value if they seemed to be from sane, normal people. She wasn't going to use them as evidence. She was going to use them, she thought, to help supplement the research. In the process, she did that, but she learned more about, like, who was having them, what kinds of situations tended to be serious topics. Most people, occasionally there would be something fun like you win the lottery, but usually it was something terrible happening to somebody you love. And that was as if psychic ability was somehow a warning system.
So you see, so you're starting to zero in. Stress, trauma, these are things that either heighten or trigger these kind of events. Mm-hmm. Was there the kind of qualitative method, or were there the qualitative methods that we now have, we know them in psychological research, that could be applied, or were you pioneers in that as well?
She was a pioneer in that. Now, she was a botanist by training, so her first job was mainly to, and she liked this, to sort of classify and organize. And she, nowadays, we're doing more qualitative stuff. I myself am doing something where we're using the computer to find out the qualities and characteristics of the people who send in the stories. Are they different from other people and so forth? But she was looking at categorizing them. For instance, she found that over 60% of the things, experiences that people report were in the dream form. And over half of these were realistic dreams like you had it last night. You know, you dreamed something exactly the way it looked like, only these were dreams that would come true in the future mm-hmm. or were happening at the moment of the dream. 30% of the cases were intuitions, waking all of a sudden, you just know that your child is sick and you run home and find out, in fact, there's been an accident and your child has been hurt. 10% of them were actually hallucinations. You didn't have any better term for that, but that was where you see something, a vision by the bed when you think you're wide awake, and that's the time that that person has passed away. Mm. Or you hear a voice saying, don't do that, and it stops you from doing something terrible like committing suicide in one story, that dramatic story that I have in my book here. But those were things that people were reporting, even though not frequently.
What are some of the other stories? Give us an example of some of the dreams that you might, particularly as a young girl, I'm imagining just hearing about these things.
Well, I can tell you some. Oh, I'll just tell you some that I'm getting right now because I've been continuing her collection, although I've been not focusing on that so much as administrative things. But here's one that comes from here in Durham. Billy Olive has a law firm in town. He's a little older than I am, Billy. When he was a young man, was overseas in the war and in World War II. But one night in December 1944, his mother got out of bed in the middle of the night, began to pace the room, wringing her hands with worry about Bill. Billy needs me, she kept saying over and over. Oh, I know Billy needs me. It was uncharacteristic of her. She'd never done that before. 2 weeks later, the family received a cable from the Army announcing that Billy had been wounded in action near the Saar River in Germany. According to Billy's sister, Betsy Ann, who I interviewed, when they later pieced together the chronicle, the hours that Mom was so distressed were the same hours that Billy was lying on the battlefield, wounded and in freezing weather. The nurse who took care of Billy at a field hospital that night later told Billy that he kept calling out, Mother, Mother, as he lay on the stretcher. Now, he recovered to tell this story, but that's a dramatic one and by somebody I know to be credible.
And certainly none of us has gone through, gotten this far without hearing those stories or having the story of saying, right. I was just about to call you or I knew something was wrong and mm-hmm. Your mother calls, that sort of thing. We've all heard those stories. We've all experienced, many of us have experienced something mm-hmm. like that. What, at a certain point, the question is, how do you test it, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Did your father ever express a kind of frustration with the, it's just hard to do that. I mean, yeah, guessing right. cards is one thing. I can number them, but I can never prove to you that, mm-hmm. well, mothers are always worried about their kids. Yeah. So, you're likely to be worried at the time exactly. your son got shot. Of course, that's, sure. You're worried mm-hmm. all the time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How do we prove it?
Yeah, and that's why they had to go to the controlled experimental work and not rely upon cases like this for evidence, although she collected 14,000 by the time she finished her collection. And if you read 100 of those in a row, you think, oh my gosh, I've almost got to just believe these. Yeah. But you don't. You use them for what you can learn about the people involved. Yeah.
What at this point, he published some research. There was some pushback, as you would hope, because this is a scientific community. How did things go for him, though, after that? Mm-hmm. Was it always a struggle? Was there ever a time when, mm-hmm. It was more accepted than not?
Not really. And even today, I could fast forward to current, in the last year, a man named Dr. Daryl Bem, a retired Cornell professor, highest credentials, published an experiment on precognition in a scientific peer-reviewed journal. And it really brought out the critics. It even made, I guess, the front page of the New York Times in some way. Here's this professor trying to claim precognition. We know there's no such thing.
And precognition is when you have a sense of something before it happens.
In that case, it would be like, knowing it wasn't a case of calling cards, but it was something similar, an experiment in which, a perfectly legitimate experiment in which something in the future seemed to be known to the person at the present or affect their behavior. He even made it was so dramatic that he even got on the Colbert Nation.
Wow. So it's got to be true. It's on Colbert. It's got to be true.
There you go.
How did you feel this whole time? Were you getting excited about this? Did you see this as an avenue for you?
Yeah, I did. I was interested in human behavior. I mean, what kid isn't? You watch your parents and your kids. You're fighting with your brother and your sister, and you're wondering, why is he acting that way? At least I was. So I'd always been interested in psychology, and I thought that would be a great career for me. But I thought it would be tied in with parapsychology. I thought my parents' work was fascinating. By the time I got into high school and was working there and meeting some of the people that would come in the lab, famous people would wander in. of the day. You probably not know them now, but remember Burl Ives was in town for the Rice Diet, and he came over. He wouldn't sing for us, but he was a famous singer, folk singer.
Boy, if that had worked on him, we wouldn't recognize him. He wouldn't be as famous as he was.
That's right. He was over a little bit overweight. But it was a great time for me because I was, by that time, realizing it was something we didn't understand, but it was part of psychology. And really, psychologists should be the ones to try to explain experiences, human experiences. So I would try to combine the two. That was my thought fairly early on.
You know, it's interesting because psychology was, and psychiatry were quite acceptable by this time. Freud was at his peak, Jung and his theories, and all of these are just narrative descriptions of things that are going on in your head. I mean, ego, superego, id. What on earth are you talking about? Go find that in your brain. And yet we accepted them as structures and reasons for our behavior.
Because they sort of fit in with what the culture had already, you know, was accepting. It wasn't that anybody really had proof of that. In fact, I used to argue with a friend of mine. How can you really? He was a Freudian. And I would argue the scientific, well, you can't bring this into the lab, you know. But no, it was a dialogue then, and it's still one today. What is conscious? When I was in, got to college, and I had some critical professors, and asked me, well, you know, you can't really explain ESP. What is that? Extrasensory perception. I'd say, well, you can't really explain consciousness either. You
know? Right.
Or for that matter, memory. Now we've done a little bit more with neurology now, but not completely.
No, we have, and we're just now beginning to find that it's not just in the brain; it's all over, and it's a matrix of physical. Mm-hmm. We can measure a lot of these things. What we can't do is find what the sum is. We just sort of follow the parts around, but we can't sum it up. Is that our problem? That we've got a scientific method that's measuring a certain kind of thing. It's really designed to measure the material world, I think. Mm-hmm. Probably in part so that we could control and exploit the material world. That's what our whole scientific priesthood is designed to do. And so then you come up with this new goal, and how do we test it now?
Yeah, and you actually, if you're a psychologist, you're looking back at the behavior of the people who were saying this. Why do you have this need for control? But anyway, that's another story. But yes, that's what science is doing. And in a way, that's what we as parapsychologists, we'd like to be able to control this too. Actually, we would, and that's would be part of the plan, ultimately.
And you mentioned a few of these different types of parapsychological or paranormal behavior, we call it now. Let's describe them for us. Let's distinguish ESP, for instance, from clairvoyance.
Yes, okay. Well, ESP would be a generic term that would cover phenomena of telepathy. I can give you little stories if you want to, or a little quickly. A telepathy story would be... like a woman who was contemplating suicide, and she heard a voice calling out to her, "Don't do that, Marion." Marion was her mother's substitute who lived 500 miles away. She wasn't present. That so shocked her into reality that she stopped her plan. And the next morning, Marion called her from Florida and said, "Hey, something's wrong. I was up all night worrying about you." And so that was a thought that would be a thought mind-to-mind transfer we would expect if that case were true. A clairvoyance was a case where you know something, you see it in your mind's eye, but it's an event. The story I have in my book here that was sent to me of a mother whose dog was lost, the family dog was lost. They put an ad in the paper, reward, finally heard from someone who told him in general where they lived and gave the address, but the mother, in her eagerness to get to the house to find the dog, forgot to bring the paper along with her. So she knew the street number, and she was saying, oh, to her son, who was 11-year-old in the back seat, oh, gee, I don't know if I can find the house. And he says, oh, I can see it. And so he says, in my mind, he could see it. He described the house, low and white house. He said there'd be two dogs playing outside. Inside, the television's going on really loud. The lady's wearing a Green Bay Packers shirt.
Green Bay Packers.
You got it right. yeah, that kind of shirt. And the living room is blue. Well, lo and behold, and Buffy was in, the dog was going to be in the inside of the house. Lo and behold, on the basis of his description, they were able to find the house on that street, and they went in, and it was exactly the way the son had described. When they got home, it didn't check everything out. The mother called back and she said, "Oh, I wanted to ask you a couple other things. What kind of shirt were you wearing?" She says, "Actually, it's a green tree, pine trees on it." So mm-hmm. It wasn't the green. But that was his only mistake. Yeah. So that was this little kid, 11 years old, somehow had a clairvoyant view of the reality of where his beloved dog would be found and was found. So that would be clairvoyance. Now, precognition would be just knowing the future. Here's a real short one, came from my mother years ago, just a typical one. I picked it up because it was short. About 15 years ago, I awoke one Monday morning about 4 a.m. I must have cried out as my wife was awakened and asked me what had happened. I replied that I had had a bad dream. In reply to her questions, I related that I had dreamed of being bitten by a rather small dog who rushed out at me from under a porch. The dog had bitten me on the calf of my left leg. The following Wednesday morning, a small dog rushed out from under a porch and bit me on the calf of my left leg, where I'm still carrying a V-shaped scar. That's just a very typical of the hundreds and
precognition.
And
then, of course, that raises all kinds of questions about whether, if we did begin to understand this a little bit better, what would that? How would the results be? Would you really avoid the mm-hmm. house with the dog? And does that mean mm-hmm. the precognition, if there's anything to it at all, that's your fate, or there's something mm-hmm. you can do about it knowing in advance?
That's a good segue, Frank. I wrote a chapter in my book that I published in 2005 called Is Fate Inevitable? And my mother did a study of these cases. I don't remember the exact detail, but she had about 400 to start with, in which you would want to avoid the disaster if you could. Some of them you might not want to avoid it. And of those, about two-thirds of them were ones in which it was impossible, or the person didn't take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
He forgot the dream until it started to happen. Or he thought, oh, I can't do anything about that, so it's probably just a dream anyway. That was a typical response of dreams. So there was a very small number.
You used the word fate, and I wonder to what extent the way in which we conceive of ourselves, of consciousness, are some of those big, giant forests that we live in are the things that make it impossible for us to take seriously the mm-hmm. study of the paranormal. In other words, would I have to accept a concept of fate, or have I ever examined what I think about my future and whether or not? All of those things are called into question when you examine these kinds of psychological phenomena mm-hmm. and they start to shake. You start to threaten them in some ways.
it can be very threatening, absolutely. We like to think that precognition is not—it's not that good. It's mm-hmm. an ability. It's like a headline that comes that my mother in the paper in we've collected these old newspaper clippings. There's a clipping from the Durham Morning Herald, which from my mother quoting my mother saying the psychic ability is not going to replace the telephone. You know,
I wish something would. At least the iPhone. The book, by the way, Sally's book is called The Gift, ESP, The Extraordinary Experiences of Ordinary People. And that's Dr. Sally Rhinefeather. Your father ran the lab for quite a while, and then he passed away. What happened to the lab?
Well, it kept going, but it didn't. We had I guess we had some leadership issues. It was hard to find a follower. He was a very charismatic and a fairly strong man with a lot of education and degrees and so forth, and brought in quite a few donors in his time. Unfortunately, he died in 1980, and I'd say by the time I came back into the field in 1995, the field had declined. The income had declined, and therefore the staff had declined, and you can't do research like this, complicated research, without funding. And we can do a lot with volunteers, and we do, but you have to have funds to continue a laboratory. So I've been involved really since 1995, first as a volunteer and development director, and then finally in the last 4 years as a director until this last summer, when I finally found a wonderful replacement. But so that was difficult, and it was just keeping it going at those times, yeah.
And the center split eventually from Duke.
Yes, before my father died, in 1965, they moved off. It was retirement time for him, and he moved off campus into a laboratory quite near the Duke campus at that time for 30 years. And now we have 12 years, we've been over on, off the West Campus in Durham.
You talked about the decline in interest. Was the heyday for this kind of research during the Cold War, when in fact certainly the Soviets were taking it seriously? We know the CIA was experimenting in various ways. Was that a time that was more comfortable for the lab?
Well, not we didn't get the government money here. My father didn't believe the field had moved to that point where they should try to apply it in that way. Other people did, and I think some good things have come from it, although ultimately the government also decided that things weren't, it was difficult to control, and I don't think that work is going on anymore. So I think after his death and his leadership left, that it just declined, probably because we didn't have a strong enough person leading it. I think the interest, the public interest, is there, and we're finding that out now.
Today on The State of Things, my guest, Sally Rhine-Feather, Executive Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center in Durham. Just ahead, we'll talk about her return to the research center and what she's up to today. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Sally Rhine-Feather, Executive Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center in Durham. So you go off, you study biology in college, and then became a psychologist. Dad's running the lab along with Mom, keeping track of the stories. Did you, how did your practice go, or your study and research? Were you thinking about this the whole time, or were you off on your own in a different direction?
Well, I worked at the Rhine Center for quite a few years before I realized that it was, for me, I didn't know enough. I felt like I needed to get more training and in a broader way, and in a psychology way. I could do experiments, but that wasn't really my forte. And so the clinical work helped me, I think, understand people better. And now that I'm working with the case material that my mother started, I'm feeling I'm combining that with the research. So I'm back into the field now.
Does that mean that if we're going to be serious about studying these kinds of phenomena, that we have to come up with new methods, and that qualitative methods are somewhere, they're the answer in a way?
Yeah, I think in a way that's really right. For instance, if you want to know how psychics work, you need to listen to them and learn them and see where they're coming from. Now, you can do controlled experiments, and there is a place still doing that kind of controlled experiment, too, where you've got to do that to nail it down and get the proof or the evidence. But you can't really understand and learn where they are and where it's coming from unless you study the characteristics of them and, first of all, listen. And so as I'm reading these cases and collecting more stories, we're then going back to the people themselves and doing questionnaires and trying to learn who they are and when did they first get this experience and how did they know to take it seriously as compared to somebody who might ignore the experience and not take it seriously. There's something within that individual. And if we can find some, we have to look for patterns, though.
Is there a scholarly way to evaluate these patterns and then make conclusions about them?
Well, you can actually just do questionnaire studies and then do factor analysis. Not called factor analysis now. And I'm not up on statistics anymore. I have young colleagues who do that. Yeah. But they analyze the results and they learn it that way, but modern methods.
And it's interesting because you talked about these methods and listening as one of the more important elements in this. And we're hearing more of this kind of qualitative literature-based study in the science academies, medical school, for instance, doctors now being taught to listen, to write stories, pay attention. Physics is now paying attention to these things, certainly quantum electrodynamics, subatomic particles. Mm-hmm. We learn defy a lot of what we thought was sensible and rational. Are these worlds starting to come together these days a little better, do you think?
I hope so. One of the things, one of our goals would be to become more integrated or more allied with other professions and not be so isolated with other, just what you said, physics, for instance, quantum physics today, you've got to be working with somebody else and you can't be an expert on that and other things as well.
And neurobiologists. Certainly understanding how complex it was. The phrenology of 125 years ago is long since passed. So there seems to be a lot more better connection.
Oh,
now,
sure.
are you making those connections? Do you feel, are other academies reaching out to you?
Not really. We're more reaching out to them, but that will happen. I mean, people will come to see us. Young graduate students will wander into our lab and become interested in what we're doing, and we will learn from them, and they will learn from us. We're hoping to make more more connections. And on a professional level, there's an international organization, the Parapsychology Association, which will be meeting here in Durham next August. And that will bring in other people from other professions. So we'd like to. We have to do that. We have to broaden our perspective.
I'm thinking particularly in the area of health now. Medicine is taking much more seriously the concept of faith in mm-hmm. healing.
Yes.
Nobody can quite explain it or put a name on it. But something's going on, and they're mm-hmm. taking it seriously.
Yes.
Is that something that you study at the Ryan Center?
Yes, actually it does. We currently have a study going on. We have a electrical engineer and my colleague, John Kruth, you met. They are... we have in our building a soundproof laboratory, and there's a dark room in which all light is excluded. In this room, we have healers, and people, well, they've run a series of experiments with healers or practitioners of meditation, and just ordinary people, too. And in this room, they can detect the light bioenergy emissions. They've discovered that some selected healers seem to be emitting ultraviolet and like it, you can tell I have not.
Yeah, but other places on the light spectrum,
yes.
And there's more of it. So
yes.
That should mean something to somebody.
We don't know what this means, but healers will tell you, many of them, if you'll ask them, they'll say, my hands are, well, I'm putting my hands over someone and trying to heal and infecting healing and getting results. My hands are very warm. And they speak about it as if they have extra energy. Now we're actually seeing it or capturing it in the laboratory. We don't know of any other research that's going on any other place that's looking at this. And so we are finding these spikes from some selected healers you and I wouldn't. I went in there, and it would be a flat line. But with these healers, we're seeing some emissions.
So again, there's something you can measure, but it seems so mm-hmm. much of what we're talking about is outside the realm of that sort of measurement and objective
yes.
measurement. That it seems do you lose the war when you agree to play by that game? It's a very limited way of examining your world,
right.
The scientific
absolutely.
Community.
What you would also want to do is spend some time talking. We've done qualitative study of healers. We haven't analyzed it yet, but one of our researchers has done that, where we're finding out when and how they develop their skills and what it means to them. And I'm collecting these stories, and I might say, bring a healer to the research lab and say, we need to study you from all sides.
Yeah, because if you think about the observation your mother made early on, that these events seem to be associated with stress, trauma, strong... Mm. The idea of even testing these things in a laboratory should strike you as a little bit wrong. We can't recreate the true emotional trigger that.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because you can't study is fate inevitable. that depends upon cases alone, but you can get some hints from that way, and we've done that for instance, we're also collecting stories now. I am and my colleague. Of the unusual physical things that people report. Now, the poltergeist-like, you've heard of poltergeist, and we all used to think of them as isolated cases. But if you start asking people, has anything unusual ever happened to you when you're under a lot of stress, you'll start getting, we are getting some remarkable reports. I have several cases here
sure.
of that type.
Give us an example.
Here's one. Recently, I was given shocking news about my job. While trying to make a phone call to reach my mother, my BlackBerry software crashed and the phone was inoperable. The phone is less than 2 months old, and this hasn't happened before. After removing the battery and reinserting it 3 times, and 10 minutes later, I was finally able to reboot it. I was finally able to reboot it. Later that night at home, my computer did the same thing, and I had to sit out the night without my Mac. And in the morning, I began thinking about my work situation and was highly upset. My thermostat began malfunctioning as soon as I physically touched it, and it wouldn't trigger the furnace. This problem has never happened before, and it cleared up on its own in the afternoon. Finally, that's one typical of a woman under stress herself. We're getting other remarkable ones since we asked. If you don't ask, you just sometimes don't know these things. We ask if anything's unusual happening around time of death, and we're getting a lot of reports like this. And, of course, folklore is full of them, you know, the clock that stopped when grandfather died and so forth.
Well, and again, you hear so many other stories about just the impact of stress on our bodies and on our hearts. Doctors will tell you, mm-hmm. you've got to lower your stress. They haven't made the link, and we haven't bothered to study exactly what I think some of that is going on. And even stories that we've done on this show talk about reconciliation, people who have been victims of crimes reconciling with the and finally being able to sleep. I mean, you know, you think, well, there was no pill involved in that. There was no surgery involved in that. And yet somehow the wiring changed and it completely changed the way a person felt physically.
Yes, yes. And we know there's so much more there that can be discovered, you know, whether you measure the energy or you just read about it and hear about it. And then you begin to look at the characteristics and the situations, and you can begin to get a picture. It's not like proof or evidence of something specifically, but it's going beyond that, really. It's saying we found things in the laboratory that we can identify called psychokinesis. Okay, so now how does it occur in everyday life? And then you can get a picture.
Psychokinesis is when you move something at a distance.
Right. I forgot the definition, but you just gave it very well.
Yeah, and are you still working on that?
We still work on it. We don't use dice anymore. And we don't. Other people have studying that, and they would use a random number generator and see if you can affect define something that can be easily studied and measured and controlled. And there are other laboratories that have studied that.
Have you ever had experiences like this personally?
No, I haven't. Well, I've had some unusual experiences, and I don't know the explanation, but they're not as striking as this.
How about your father? Had he ever experienced any of this?
No, not really. He really came at this from an intellectual point of view, professional point of view. My mother started keeping accounts of children when they were little. And in my book here, I have one chapter about mother's ESP. And she would, by just noticing little things that were going around the house, she collected quite a series of events with the children, like the night she and my sister woke up with the same scary dream and the rooms were separated and so forth, and that sort of thing.
And what about research on people who've tried to cultivate any of these skills or gifts, if you will?
We haven't found that to be very effective yet. We think we can. We think that's possible. But it's not very striking yet. At this point in time, we wouldn't say that psychic ability is something that could be learned. What we think can happen is the conditions under which psi ability works can be simulated and can be reproduced. And we know that from the laboratory studies. We know that meditation is a very important factor that's been demonstrated. So we would tell somebody, you want to become more psychic, clear your mind, get away from the left brain kind of organized things of the day, other things of that, hints of that sort.
So it's possible that rather than being able to cultivate the skill, we need to degenerate or disable the blocks or barriers.
You're absolutely right. And this fits in with a first sight theory. That's the name of it, first sight theory, that Dr. James Carpenter of our research staff has developed and will be publishing this next year, which implies that psi ability is something very basic. It's the first sight, not the second sight, but it underlies your subliminal perception so that it's there all the time, but most of us have learned to block it out. Our bodies have trained us to pay attention to things outside ourselves and not inside ourselves.
Did your father ever speculate, or have you, about whether or not this is a skill that we have lost over time, that maybe modern times has made us more afflicted and less sensitive to?
Some people, I sort of think of psi as the psychic cell phone of caveman.
So it was around and maybe more of us had it. What do we know, and did your father make any guesses about or was able to demonstrate anything about those among us who seem to have a better cultivated, are more sensitive to these kinds of things? Well, just biology?
Probably people that are more, I would say, creative. And this has been established too, creative, musical, artistic, more apt to listen to their, perhaps more sensitive to their environment than many of us who have been working at our desk and watching our computer all day long, so forth. The creative type of people, and that's been fairly well known. Thin boundaries, meaning sensitive to the environment. And some of these, this has been established in many studies in the laboratory, but outside the laboratory, you can observe the same thing. Also, the genetic link. You mentioned your grandmother. Well, that's not at all unusual that somebody has a psychic grandmother and then they or somebody in their family begins to have psychic experiences.
So what's going on at the lab these days?
Well, I mentioned the research in the laboratory upstairs, the electrical output.
Right.
We have several other studies beginning. the study that Dr. John Palmer, our director of research, is doing on dissociation and motor abilities. You know, we all, when you drive to work, your mind is not really on the car very well. During a time like that, when your mind is not on something, you're more likely to be psychic. Hmm. And he's studying, he has a ESP experiment that goes along with this dissociation. And I think he's still looking for more participants if people want to come to the laboratory.
And there's a sort of the pathological part of the spectrum where you literally leave your body, usually under stress. People report sort of seeing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Out of the body's experiences. Yeah. We have that too, and that could be related to what we do to some extent. That's one research, the electrical research I mentioned. We're going to be repeating Dr. Bim's research on the precognition experiment. That's too complicated to go into now, but... And I'm collecting my stories, which people can send in to me still. And that's on our website, and we should mention our website, www.rhine.org. And, of course, that's Rhine, spelled R-H-I-N-E. And on our website, which is being redesigned, but even now it's pretty user-friendly. And it'll have lots of opportunities for people to see what we're doing and also to learn. We have a very large experimental program, I mean, educational program, I should say.
Any thought to getting back together with Duke and becoming part of the university?
I think we would be open to an academic association with some university. I'm not sure that would be in the cards for Duke at this time, but I think some small university, actually the University of West Georgia is teaching a course now with one of our former our research staffs is down there now. She's working on staff, and they're teaching courses on parapsychology, and they'll be co-sponsoring a conference that we're holding here in March. So I think at a small college somewhere, we'll probably take this on. It would be in England, in Europe, across the United Kingdom. There are 7 or 8 universities in which parapsychology is now entrenched.
Is this being taken more seriously in Europe, and is there any place in the world that it's being taken very seriously?
I would say the UK is the best, and they've been the longest established.
Sally, great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Sally Rhine-Feather, my guest. She is the Director Emeritus of the Rhine Research Center here in Durham and author of The Gift, ESP, The Extraordinary Experiences of Ordinary People. For more information, you can go to rhine.org, spell Rhine, R-H-I-N-E.org. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can find a calendar of events, and you will find on there a big event Friday, November 4th. That's this coming Friday at the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapahaw. Playwright Howard Kraft is going to be there, the cast of Jade City Pharaoh, an upcoming radio drama series here on The State of Things featuring Black superhero premiering on The State of Things. And on the 4th, you will hear music from Kim Arrington, Sherlett Emmons, and the Dynamite Brothers, spoken word by the Sacrificial Poets. You will see performed live the pilot of Jade City Chronicles and the Jade City Fair. I hope to see you there on the 4th. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.